I'm Jamie Seeker, and this is What It Takes. Each episode, I sit down with real business owners to talk about their journey, the wins, the challenges, and everything in between. Let's dive in.
Welcome back to What It Takes, the podcast where we dive deep into journeys of entrepreneurs, creators, and business owners who built something incredible. I'm your host, Jamie Seeker, and today we're talking about architecture, but not just any architecture. We're talking about the kind that makes life better, more beautiful, and more sustainable. Our guest today is Tessa Bradley, co-principal of Artisans Group, an award-winning architecture firm based in the Pacific Northwest. She and I were just having a great conversation about her state, and I can't wait to visit it this summer, but I'm going to leave it to her. Tessa is a big picture thinker, a sustainability expert, and someone who believes that the best design is both functional and beautiful. She's one of the top architects in passive house design, meaning she creates ultra energy efficient buildings that help people live more sustainably without sacrificing style. But here's what's really cool. Tessa isn't just an architect. She's also former roller derby competitor, an artist, and a musician. So today, we're not only going to explore her career journey, but also how her unique experiences have shaped the way she thinks about design. And of course, we'll wrap up with our signature question, what does it take to build a successful and meaningful career. So let's dive in. Hi, Tessa.
Hi, Jamie. Thanks for having me.
So I just want to dive in and talk a little bit about your design philosophy. So you're known for elegant and highly efficient design. So what's your secret to solving complex problems with simplicity?
So we like to address things early. You know, it's very hard to take the way that we've always designed buildings and just apply this approach and science to it and have it make sense when you're done. You have to really start from an evolved and different mindset. So you have to really come at the building knowing where you're heading in terms of your energy performance and your sustainability and how you're going to do something exceptional and different. And you have to have those concepts and, you know, the knowledge of having done so many at this point is a real advantage we have. You have to bring that into the process before you've even started, before you've even put pen to paper. And so we already know the bits of how to design windows, let's say, for a really high performance building. We're going to incorporate that from the beginning instead of saying, well, this is how we've always done buildings and now we're going to apply these high performance windows. We're going to start knowing that we're heading towards a certain goal. And so we find that when you have that more integrated design approach in the beginning, you're not making compromises between aesthetics and performance and the goals of your project. And you can honor the budget a lot more too by having those goals in mind from the very beginning.
Yeah, that's quite a philosophy. I love that. Let's talk, though, about passive houses and sustainability, because you mentioned a little bit about, you know, that knowledge in how to, you know, install the windows that way. But like, what makes passive house design so revolutionary? Like, why isn't everyone doing it? Why is this the future of sustainable living and not something that like we're just automatically doing in our day-to-day design?
That's a great question, Jamie. You know, it's building things is really hard, right? You take an imperfect idea and you have it drafted and designed by an imperfect architect. Then you have it run through an imperfect banking and estimating system to be built by an imperfect builder with imperfect materials. And it's like there's nothing more like building the plane as you're trying to fly it than building things.
Yeah.
So I think people get frustrated, you know, if they're in other industries that have more finite knowns. You know, like I imagine, and I'm speaking, you know, probably out of turn, but, you know, when I meet with like financiers, like there are known qualities about their industry, things they expect, dependable, finite, black and white things. Everything is moving at the same time in construction. You're building a design that's never been built, you know, possibly with a technology and innovation that's never been done. And so, I don't really hold it against the industry that we're slow to change, because what we're doing is innately difficult and very complicated to begin with. But passive house is a way to think about buildings instead of just the components we always use, which are kind of like paper thin walls, double paned windows, you know, this way that we've built for, let's say, you know, 60 years. It really hasn't changed that much. But if we think about buildings as needing to be better shells, really. So that's, you know, that's how I think about passive house. It's like putting a big woolly sweater around your house. And then you don't need as complex or as much heating and cooling because you've really done a good job with your sweater. So maybe you can turn, it's like when you live in an old home, like I do, you can turn the heat down if you wander around your house in socks and sweats and a beanie and a sweater, right? Like, so we do a better job with the shell and the building innately gets more comfortable and more healthy.
I love that. And I love that you're kind of giving that perspective in the kind of that not a pass to the industry, but just a perspective that I kind of, as much as I've worked a lot in that build industry, I didn't really have that perspective. So I like how you said that. We're trying to build the plane as it's flying. And, you know, and people have not built this specific design before, right? I mean, unless you're in like a tract home or something like that, sure. Like there are efficiencies that you can come up with and whatnot, but that's a really great perspective to have. So what was that step of breaking into architecture? What first drew you to that? And like, how did you find your niche in that sustainable design area?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was very fortunate and very lucky to have wonderful parents. And my dad teaches drafting at a local community college. So I grew up with a hand drafting board in my living room. And he worked by day as a teacher and by night for developers drawing plans and things like that. And so I had a lot of exposure to the industry really young. And I was really fortunate to have that because there's not a lot of female architects compared to how many male counterparts we have, you know, and there's a lot of reasons why that may be the case. But one of them is definitely representation. I don't think I met a female architect, a licensed architect, till I almost was one. You know what I mean?
That's crazy.
And I know that sounds insane in today's world, but, you know, I think less than like 25% of the licensed architects in the US are women, and less than 1% of firm owners like myself are women. So it's still just a very unrepresented field in terms of diversity. And don't even get me started on, you know, people of color, another very unrepresented demographic in architecture.
Yeah, but that's kind of cool to having that legacy of it being passed down and something you were always exposed to. But you think about that in thinking about diverse communities and females and whatnot, like we aren't necessarily at home during childhood watching, you know, dad draft buildings and right. things like that. So that's actually a really cool exposure to it. And I could see why that's something that you would, you know, why wouldn't I love that industry. And I think there's the creative side of it, but there's such the technical side of it as well. So you kind of have both of that. But
it is like if you're one of those people that's right brain, left brain, you know, you like math, but you also like art.
Yes.
And if the world never really made a box for you, you know, it could be that architecture is a really great fit.
This is it. Yep, absolutely. I see that too. And you helped transform Artisans Group from residential projects to neighborhood scale and commercial work. So let's get into once you actually made that decision and you said, okay, I'm going to go down this path. What was that the biggest challenge in making that shift once you were in?
You know, I would say the biggest challenge to our growth as a firm has been that there's always ways that an industry works. So, you know, typically architecture is kind of like dynasties. You know, someone builds a firm, they get this great portfolio of work, they bring up architects under them, and then those architects buy them out and they retire, hopefully. That's the dream, right? And then they take over their portfolio of work. And even though that architect doesn't work there anymore, they still get to say when they apply for, like, let's say, you know, federal project or a port project or something like that, they can say, we have this long history of all these port projects. So in our industry, there's this expectation that you really have to have done the thing you're trying to apply to do before. And so our biggest challenge is that, well, you know, in my experience, you know, I didn't see any women on that path, right? It was typically white male-owned firms promoting, you know, people they most related to themselves. And so not being given those opportunities, we formed our firm, me and my co-principal, Rusa Cassell, as a 100% women-owned firm. And we have to really, you know, claw and fight and push a little harder to be able to win that work because we haven't inherited sort of the benefit of our forefathers' experience and portfolio. So I would say that's our biggest challenge to doing large scale work. We've made incredible inroads and we're starting to have, you know, a portfolio that can really win us anything that we want. But, you know, we had to have really exceptional people choose to use us before we had that kind of history.
Yeah. And that's great. I mean, it sounds like that journey may have even contributed to finding kind of your niche too, like having to be able to stand out in, like you said, everybody's kind of doing things this way. And we're all just trying to make it work. We'll just build something. But how do we do this that's a little bit different? And I mean, I'm not saying that that's the reason why, but I'm sure that that was a factor in having to distinguish yourselves in that way as well. Not just excellence, but in something that's going to catch somebody's attention.
There definitely is, you know, whether it's real or perceived, you know, like I feel like as a woman architect, I have to not just be in the middle of my class, I have to be the top of my class. And really everything has to be a step above my competitors because I have to sort of prove not just to my clients that I'm just as good as my counterpart, but I have to really represent for all the aspiring, you know, young architects that work for me. And so there's definitely a degree of public pressure and a degree of private pressure that comes from being a little unique in your industry.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that a little bit. Women in Architecture is one of the first 10 female certified passive house consultants in the US. What challenges have you faced there and how has the industry changed since you've come on board?
You know, it's been exciting to participate in. I have just always been a building science nerd. And so I got interested in passive house really early before it really was a really prevalent movement in the US. They were just getting their feet under them in terms of people even knowing what it was. And of course, it has a terrible name, passive house. Don't get me started on the branding involved in that, but it's a wonderful approach that has a terrible name. So, you know, I got into that early. And, you know, now people are seeking us out because people are recognizing that if they want a long-term asset, either a home or a commercial building or an investment, like the mixed-use building I'm building to be our new company's office next to me here, I'm in my job hut. You know, there is a different strategy to having something that has great longevity and better human health and better energy performance. You know, electricity is becoming one of the new financial fronts in our state, you know, as a very limited resource, right? And I don't think that's unique to our state. I think that's sort of a national problem. And in the same way that we're trying to control the rising costs of living, I think that the cost of energy is going to become a huge part of that. So I think, you know, smart consumers, smart clients are thinking ahead and realizing that their retirement, how far their money is going to go, their financial freedom, the value of their asset, all of these things can be tied to the quality, the health, and the performance of what you choose to develop. So it's not really just for hippies anymore. And it's not just for, you know, I've had very, you know, conservative clients that don't even necessarily believe in climate change, but they believe in the financial resiliency of this approach. And I really love, you know, as a centralist, I really love anything that has common goals for anyone with any belief, right? Sometimes things are just so good that they can work for everyone. And that's definitely been the case with passive house, regardless of how you feel about, you know, the problem of how we build buildings, whether they make people sick, whether they decay as assets, whether they're bad for the environment. All of those things are really remedied by more thoughtful, more considered, more measurably better buildings. And this approach, you know, I'm a lead AP. I was really into a lot of different ways to do what we're trying to do. And this approach, you know, kind of drives me mad. It's very, very nerdy. It's very scientific. And sometimes the things I do just, you know, make me want to quit. But when you can start to come towards it with this science behind you, with passive house as a support system for better buildings, you can really start to see where we're heading and why it matters. And this is the best way to get there, in my experience so far in my 25-year career.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think too, like you were saying, whether you agree with it or not, or whether, you know, whatever, wherever you stand on the bigger issue, at the end of the day, everyone loves a good business deal. And from a financial standpoint, it makes absolute sense. And so I like that it can speak to the different sides of it, but also, you know, you're putting out a good product at the end of the day that is going to
pay you dividends in the future as well. So I think all of us are kind of looking for that. So on that business note, that business side of things, many architects struggle with business side of things. And not just, I wouldn't say just architects per se. I would say any professional that gets into their trade and then becomes, you know, a business owner because of that trade. You're not necessarily thinking of, oh, I want to do this because I want to like own my own business. You're just like, I want to do this because I want to do what I love to do. I want to build, or I want to, you know, create, or, you know, whatever it is that you're doing. What have you learned about scaling a design firm successfully?
Oh my goodness. That is such a broad question. I definitely have had great mentorship. You know, I was a design build firm originally, and I was a contractor as well for a decade. And I had a wonderful business partner who was very brilliant and taught me a lot of business concepts that I don't think I could have learned any other way except by him patiently showing me. And I now, you know, my current business partner is our CFO, and she's brilliant and just the most brilliant architect I've ever worked with in my career. And, you know, I think that like constant mentorship is really important. You know, I think it's very hard to maintain. I mean, now, you know, I think every industry is different. I manage creative people, you know, and that is its own challenge. And then, you know, my role as our CEO is the most different role from every role in my company. You know, here's everyone else and their roles all overlap and they all touch. And their jobs have so many similarities and they're thinking the same way about the same thing. And then, you know, my business partner kind of overlaps in the middle, like her role overlaps with their role. And then here I am, an island out here, worried about our 5-year plan and trying to make a relationship to win a big project 2 years from now. And so I think it can be hard to maintain the humility to be an expert and be learning at all times. At least I try, and sometimes I succeed more than others. And then it's also, you know, quite lonely to be in the position that I am in many ways, which I said to a group of young women in a high school in a STEM program I was meeting with. And I was just like, that was probably too honest. Now they're probably not going to want to be CEOs, but the, you know, many of them appreciated it. You know, I think it's very easy to sort of romanticize leadership, because those that crave power probably shouldn't have it. And those of us that do, you know, have more responsibility than is maybe fun.
I thank you so much for saying that. And I'm going to say, you just really touched on one of the reasons why we have this podcast in the first place, is that we work with a lot of clients who are business owners. And I experience it myself as a business owner. It is a lonely road. And just for the sheer foundation, like how everything is set up, we are set up to be the ones to make all the decisions, to carry all the weight, as we should. I don't think there's anything dynamically wrong per se with it, other than if that's all we're doing and that's where we stick to, I don't think we're meant to do anything alone, really. We are collaborators naturally. And you were saying, you know, one of the best advice I think came out of this is like mentorship is extremely important. It's leaning on other people, other knowledge, and continuing to learn and continuing to grow. And one, by design, we as business owners are alone. And yeah. and we have to seek out our network, our community, and other people that we can lean on. And really, that's why this podcast started, is we want to talk about what it's really like to be a business owner, what it's really going to take. And that just leads right into our signature question, was what does it take? What does it actually take? And we're not talking you don't have to be mindful of your audience. There's not going to be influential, you know, teenage girls who are maybe considering, you know, things. What does it really take? Like if you're going to go down this road, or you are sitting in the seat, what do you need to hear right now?
I think of two things. One, I think that I could not do it without the love, friendship, support, professionalism, all the things that I get from my partner, my business partner. You know, I really believe in partnerships. And I believe that if you can find someone that you can build your world with, that you should take that opportunity. I see many people struggle to be single proprietors, and they, you know, experience that isolation from both, you know, the people they serve and the people that work for them. Without that bridge and without, you know, someone seeing what they do and understanding its relevance and being appreciated in that way. So, you know, I think that partnerships are really powerful. And so that's another way to say, you know, the community piece that you say, but specifically, I feel like at least, you know, partners in a business can be really powerful. I mean, unless your partner sucks, but you know, there's lots of wonderful people in the world. I'm sure you can find one,
yes.
Right?
Like, yes. Fair. That's fair. Partnerships can be powerful.
They can be powerful.
With
but
the
also,
right people.
It's a good way to also exercise like the humility too, and like the practice of needing to compromise. It's, you know, I think it's maybe a lost art in leadership in this country, perhaps, that compromise is actually a really powerful position to have. Power over a situation, but see someone's point of view is very powerful. So that's the first thing I think of, you know, and then the second thing I think of is I should stop being amazed by it, but thinking like an employee is very different than thinking like an owner. And so people will often express to me their interest in ownership without understanding how different their behavior and their life would be to be an owner versus an employee. And so the way that I've kind of built my philosophy around that in my head, at least, is that you act like an owner until you are one. And if you act like an employee, you will always be an employee. Because that's how I got my, you know, I acted like an owner until I was made one. People who act like owners become so critical and essential to a business that the business literally can't function without them. And so you don't do that. You don't get made an owner and then you act like an owner. The only way to become a principal, at least in my opinion, is to act like one long enough that no one can live without you. And I think that is a strategy that I say, but I think is very lost in the noise of all the things we're trying to do and all the things we're trying to handle and cope with. It's a hard industry. But I really think that if people who are interested in this level of leadership, that is kind of the only strategy and really the only thing that matters.
I think that that's actually really, really deep. And I'd love if we had time to pick that apart, but we don't. But it's enough for me to just kind of take, and I say it all the time. It's just, you know, if you can be trusted with a little, you can be trusted with a lot. And there's something to having a certain perspective, having and living that out, right? Then just always being, oh, well, if I were in that seat, that's what I would do. Well, do it now then.
Right.
Or if I ever had this, you know, and you see that in all different scales. And so whether it's, you know, a part-time employee that's doing one little thing, how they do that seemingly mindless task is like, oh, I can tell just from how you're handling that, your perspective and the way that you do it, you're going to go far in this company and I'm going to give you more and more and more and more and more. And it doesn't really matter what the job is. It's more who it is. And I think we're kind of getting to that in like every little section that we talked about, right? It's like, you know, yeah, partnerships can be really powerful with the right person, mentorship, you know, and perspective too. In, hey, if you're really looking to get into this and you really want to know what it takes, well, then start thinking about it now. And you don't need to wait for any kind of, you know, moment or position or anything like that. That's so wonderful.
And be intentional, because I think that the sort of the crushing weight of responsibility and leadership is not necessarily something that makes your life great. So like, I feel like some people have figured out that they're just going to be a great employee. And that actually is a wonderful quality of life decision for them. And like, I have nothing but respect for that position. What I think people need to do though is be honest and be intentional about where they're going and why. Because I do see and hear, you know, out in the world of architecture, a lot of people that want leadership and aren't doing the things necessary to get it. So right. Either resolving your goals or resolving your strategy.
Yes.
But you know, I think that's kind of what I think about when you ask that question.
Yeah, acceptance is a big part of that. And what I mean by that is most people say, oh, I want this, I want that, I want that. But when you actually, okay, well, let's kind of peel back those layers. What are you doing with your time? What are you doing with your money? What are you doing with your, and you're like, well, this is telling me that that's not what you want. So that's fine. You can either change your behavior or accept that that's not what you want. Which one do you want to do? And I'm sure there's a lot of gray in between. But for the most part, it's like, hey, you either need to accept that that's not actually what I want, own it, and that's great. That is,
Jamie,
we need
I think
people.
You just broke down years of therapy it took me to learn that look at what people do, not what they say.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's, I mean, it's
a very I do it
hard,
too. We all do it.
It's a very hard lesson.
Right? We all do it. And I think, but when we're called to attention of it, what are we going to do with that information? You're right. I'm not acting like how I feel or even what I want. So if I really do want these things, let me go ahead and I'm going to change what that looks like. Or, you know what? I'm not really willing to give that up. That is a priority for me. I am going to continue to go down that road. I need to change my perspective. I need to change my narrative. I don't actually want those things. I want what I'm doing right now. Guess what? That's okay too.
Yes.
And it's so hard to abandon that sometimes identity that we think we're like moving toward. To
ambition
say,
can be wonderful or it can make you miserable because it can make you want things that don't make you happy.
And the freedom comes when you've accepted really where you are and those things are in alignment. But oh my gosh, wow. I think that if we kept going, this would go on. But I am completely inspired by this in conversation. Tessa, thank you so much. I love how you've simplified these complex problems and then just relating it back to architecture. I mean, you're putting that into your design and your function and your approach to sustainability. It's something we can all learn from. And if you want to see more of Tessa's work and you've kind of resonated with anything that we've talked about today, Tessa, where can they find you guys?
Oh, please come visit us at www.artisansgroup.com. And we have a strong social media on Instagram as well. You can see our projects. And stay tuned. We're building a certified passive house mixed use building for our new office. We're about 3 months away from being done. And it has six certified passive house apartments above it. And so we've learned a lot in the process. And I'm sure we'll be doing some lectures and doing some blogs and doing some videos about our experience and all the things that we should have done differently.
Yes, please check them out, guys. This has been such a learning thing for me in this short conversation. If you've also learned anything from this or even just enjoyed this episode, please make sure to subscribe, leave a review, share it with a friend who would love to hear Tessa's story. And as always, thanks for tuning in to What It Takes. Until next time, keep pushing the boundaries and building something great. This podcast is brought to you by Seeker Solution. Are you a business owner feeling overwhelmed? We can help. Head over to SeekerSolution.com to schedule a call today. Would you or someone you know like to be featured on this podcast? Our applications are now open. Apply today at SeekerSolution.com and click on the podcast link to get started.